given seats on company boards to inject some much-needed common sense and restraint. We need an economy that delivers better living standards for all the people, not just for those at the top. According to the annual research from the High Pay Center, the median pay of a FTSE 100 chief executive officer last year hit £3.91 million, the highest level since 2017, and half a million pounds higher than 2021. The Press Association, PA Media, has also covered the same story. According to new research, the bosses of Britain's biggest companies saw their pay surge by 16% last year, as most workers saw their pay packets outstripped by inflation. The High Pay Centre said chief executive officers for firms on the FTSE 100, the index of Britain's largest publicly listed companies, had an average pay rise of around half a million pounds, £500,000, in 2022. Union said the data shows that Britain has become a land of grotesque extremes. The High Pay Centre said median pay for a FTSE 100 chief executive officer increased from £3.38 million in 2021 to £3.91 million in 2022. It represents a continued upward trend after it dropped to £2.46 million in 2020 as companies were impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The research shows that the gap between bosses and workers widened further over the past year, with it recording that the median FTSE 100 chief executive officer was paid 118 times the median British full-time worker salary, up from 108 times in 2021. The AstraZeneca boss, Pascal Soriot, was the highest-earning FTSE 100 chief executive after receiving a pay of £15.3 million for the year. Other particularly highly paid chief executives included Charles Woodburn of British Aerospace Systems, Bernard Looney of British Petroleum BP, and Ben Van Burden of Shell. The High Pay Centre has called for new requirements for companies to include a minimum of 2 elected workforce representatives on the remuneration committees that set executive pay. Over the past year, multiple British public sectors, from junior doctors and teachers to rail staff and bus drivers, have all been striking as their wages remain the same despite the economic crisis. Although Britain's inflation level is hovering at 6.8%, down from 7.8% in June, the country recently recorded the highest price increases among the group of 7 G7 industrialised nations. The Bank of England has increased its key interest rate more than a dozen times in succession to try to lower inflation. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered the same story. According to a separate study by housing charity Shelter, one-third of working tenants in England do not have enough savings to pay rent if they lose their job, which puts them at risk of losing their homes amid the cost of living crisis in the country. Shelter's survey of more than 2,000 tenants found that 55% had seen their rent go up this year, and 37% were struggling to pay or had already fallen behind as a result of an increase. Polly Neat, Shelter's chief executive, said private renters were facing a crisis like never before. She added, "The severe lack of social homes means swathes of people are barely scraping by as they're forced to compete for grossly expensive private rentals because there is nothing else to rent." She underlined, "With food and household bills continuing to surge, the situation is precarious for thousands of renters who are one paycheck away from losing their home and a spectre of homelessness. According to official government data for January to March of this year, published in July, around 79,840 households were owed help from local authorities to address homelessness or the risk of homelessness, as experts blamed a shameful lack of social housing in Britain. Data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, showed private rental prices paid by tenants in the United Kingdom have jumped by 5.3% in the 12 months leading up to July, marking the largest annual percentage change since records began in 2016. The figure was up from 5.2% in the previous month, with costs consistently increasing over the past 2 years. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, annual private rental prices surged by 5.2% in England, 6.5% in Wales, 5.7% in Scotland. Within England, the highest annual percentage change in private rental prices was in the West Midlands area, followed by Yorkshire and Humberside, and also London at 5.5%, while the northeast of England saw the lowest increase at 4.6%. According to the report, the average house price in the United Kingdom was £288,000 or $368,000 in June. Average house prices increased over the year by 1.9% to $391,000 in England, by 0.6% to $272,000 in Wales, and by 2.7% to $222,000 in Northern Ireland. House prices in Scotland stayed practically unchanged at an average of $241,000.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malawi.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world.
Ah.
Parts of Ziyara text of Jama'atul Kabira issued by Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawilluha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues and the conversations of Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. In this episode, though, I want to talk about a conversation that deals about Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. Now, one of the things that we see in the life of this esteemed 10th divinely appointed Imam, of course, is this asceticism, this piety, and this refraining from worldly and materialistic pleasures. So on the path of spirituality, of course, the closer you become to the spiritual world and the more du'as that you do, the more supplications that you do, the more prayers that you do, and really the more that you walk upon the path of the obedience to the Almighty Allah, the more you begin to detach yourself from the materialistic world. And this is kind of a very natural thing to occur on spiritual wayfaring. In this one conversation, we find that some of the policemen and the investigators of Mutawakkil Abbasi, who was the Abbasid Caliph at the time, they would regularly break into Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam's house. Now, of course, they were looking for secret correspondence between Imam al-Hadi and his followers, or perhaps a lot of wealth which could have been or might have been being collected at the hands of Imam al-Hadi. Because, of course, even though the Abbasid caliphs did not acquiesce to the position of the divinely appointed imams, but nonetheless, they very well knew the divinely appointed imams and they knew their position, their socio-political position amongst the Muslims. They knew that they were the leaders of the pure Muhammadan Islam movement. And so they were always breaking down into their houses, trying to, you know, catch them doing something. And so one time the policemen of Mutawakkil broke into the house of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and they searched it from top to bottom, and they found that there was practically nothing of worldly furniture. And they found that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was wearing a piece of wool garment, and he was sitting on sand and pebbles, meaning that there was no carpet or some kind of cushion or something under him. He was sitting on the bare ground. And so one of these individuals, they said that, I had thought that he was the leader of the Shia and he was the leader of the Rafidi, as was a derogatory term that was used for the Shia at that time, and still today some people unfortunately do. He said that I thought that he would be amass in wealth. And the other person says, isn't it strange that we see that Ali al-Hadi, he seems to have no interest in this worldly life. He keeps to the mosque and the masjid, and when we search his house, we only find copies of the Holy Quran or books of dua or scientific books. And so both of these individuals, policemen of Al-Mutawakkil, really amazed at the materialistic detachment of Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, a lesson for every single one of us also, that we must detach ourselves from these materialistic pleasures, these worldly pleasures. Yes, in a balanced manner, these are halal and they are recommended and they are necessary, but many times we go towards the side of extravagance and ultra luxuriousness, and these will definitely lead to our detriment. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
An admission by the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows could complicate Donald Trump's defense in his classified documents case. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster ABC News has covered this story. Appearing to contradict former President Donald Trump's primary public defense in the classified documents case, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had told Special Counsel Jack Smith investigators that he could not recall Donald Trump ever ordering or even discussing declassifying broad sets of classified materials before leaving the White House. Nor was he aware of any standing order from Donald Trump authorizing the automatic declassification of materials taken out of the Oval Office. Sources familiar with the matter have told ABC News. Ever since the FBI's seizure of more than 100 classified documents from his Mar-a-Lago estate last August, Donald Trump has insisted that he declassified all the materials before he left office. The former president now faces 40 separate criminal charges relating to his possession of those documents, ranging from unlawful retention of national defense information to various obstruction-related offenses. Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to all charges and has denied any wrongdoing. ABC News has also reviewed an early draft of the prologue to Mark Meadows' book, The Chief's Chief, about his time serving as Trump's chief of staff for the final months of the Trump White House, which includes a description of Trump having a declassified war plan on the couch at his office in Bedminster, New Jersey, at a meeting attended by Mark Meadows as ghostwriter and publicist, but not by Mark Meadows himself. The reference to that document being in Trump's possession was removed before the book was published. Multiple sources have told ABC News that Mark Meadows acknowledged to investigators that he asked that the paragraph be changed and that it would be problematic had Donald Trump had such a document in his possession. Sources tell ABC News that Mark Meadows told special counsel investigators that they did not discuss making those edits with Donald Trump. Mark Meadows also told investigators that he was not involved in packing the boxes that Donald Trump took to Mar-a-Lago after leaving the White House. Mark Meadows has largely distanced himself from the removal of government documents from the White House, including classified materials. The sources said Mark Meadows told investigators he did not witness Donald Trump himself packing boxes and was unaware that Donald Trump had taken any government records, including classified documents. The former White House chief of staff also told investigators that shortly after the National Archive first requested the return of the official documents taken to Mar-a-Lago in 2021, he offered to Trump that he would go through the former president's boxes to retrieve the official records and send them back to Washington. Mark Meadows told investigators that Trump did not accept his offer, according to sources. Following the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago in August of 2022, Donald Trump's team issued a statement to one media outlet claiming that, while still in office, Trump had issued a standing order that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to his residence at Mar-a-Lago were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them from the White House. On social media, Trump himself insisted that the documents at Mar-a-Lago were all declassified. According to sources familiar with the matter, Mark Meadows told investigators that he had heard the term standing order used during his time in the White House, but not in relation to the declassification process. While Trump's attorneys have not formally put forward such a defense in court, if they were to seek to make such a claim at trial, then prosecutors could see substantial value in putting forward Mark Meadows as a witness to counter such claims. In a statement to ABC News, a Trump spokesperson without evidence accused the Justice Department of selectively leaking incomplete information to impact the 2024 presidential election. The statement claimed the Department of Justice and the special counsel have resorted to selectively leaking incomplete information that lacks proper context because they know they can't win inside a courtroom. So, now they're trying to deceive Americans through the court of public opinion. They added, "This witch hunt is nothing more than a desperate attempt to interfere in the 2024 election as President Trump dominates the polls and is the only person who will take back the White House." Mark Meadows recalled to investigators only one instance in his time serving as Trump's chief of staff where he claimed to see Trump declassifying documents involving a binder with materials from the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane investigation into Donald Trump's 2016 campaign's lies with Russia. Multiple sources familiar with the matter have confirmed. That order in the final days of Trump's time in the White House has been a subject of dispute, however, as the Justice Department has resisted publicly releasing the purported documents at issue. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows told investigators he had no knowledge of Donald Trump either talking about or declassifying confidential information. It was reported on Sunday, 20th of August, potentially skewering the former president's defense in his classified documents case. Mark Meadows' alleged admission to the special counsel Jack Smith, reported by ABC News, suggests that Donald Trump made no blanket declassification of secret papers later seized from his Mar-a-Lago resort by FBI agents, leading to 40 criminal counts against him. Donald Trump, who pleaded not guilty to all the charges, has insisted without proof that he gave automatic clearance to every government document he took to Florida at the conclusion of his administration in January of 2021. While his lawyers have not yet presented the defense in court, and doing so could open the possibility of Mark Meadows being called as a witness to contradict it. According to ABC News, Mark Meadows also told Special Counsel Jack Smith he was not involved in packing the boxes and did not witness Donald Trump or anybody else doing so, and claimed he was not aware the former president was taking anything with him. If true, it would be extraordinary that one of Donald Trump's closest aides and chief of staff had absolutely no knowledge of anything to do with the retention of the documents. It might also suggest that Donald Trump knew what he was talking and planned and executed the operation himself. Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence also said he was unaware of any standing order for declassifying documents. Asked about the report, he told ABC's This Week program, "There is a process that the White House goes through to declassify materials. I'm aware of that occurring on several occasions over the course of our 4 years in office, but I don't have any knowledge of any broad-based directive from the president." Mike Pence, now challenging his former boss for the Republican presidential nomination, added, "That doesn't mean it didn't occur. It's just not something that I ever heard about." Asked if Mark Meadows, as Trump's chief of staff, should have been aware of any such broad declassification order from Donald Trump, Mike Pence said, "I would expect so." Meadows, who has remained publicly silent about the documents case, was indicted along with Donald Trump and 17 other individuals last week by Fannie Willis, the district attorney for Fulton County, Georgia, who is investigating efforts to reverse Joe Biden's election win in Georgia in 2020.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, be very careful who you get your religion from. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, welcome. It is such an honor to be here at your service. What we're talking about today, very quickly and briefly, is to be very careful where we get our religion from. Now, of course, when we are talking about an Islamic lifestyle, well, we need to learn that Islamic lifestyle one way or the other. Now, of course, one way to learn this Islamic lifestyle is to go to the source, which is the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, as well as the Holy Quran. But sometimes, yes, we can get some basic things like that, and if we have good self-motivation, we can actually learn quite a bit in this manner by going towards the traditions and the riwayat and the ahadith of the Messenger of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, that are accepted This is one way, of course, and the Holy Quran, if we have the motivation. Sometimes, though, unfortunately, we kind of don't have the motivation to do that on our own. Some people, they prefer to go and listen to a religious scholar. They prefer to listen to the ulama, and this is how they learn, you know, about the Holy Quran, and they learn about the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Now, both ways are good. Most probably to do both ways is better instead of just choosing one. Yes, we should have our own, you know, time to read the traditions. We should find our own time to read the Holy Quran and try to understand as best as we can, of course. But for the more intricate details and the fine lines need to be understood, then yes, we need to refer, and we must refer to the ulama, the religious scholars, to understand the Holy Quran at a higher level and to understand the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam at a higher level with more depth and to understand more of its complexities. Now, this is what we're talking about here, is be careful who you learn your religion from. Now, of course, there are individuals who claim to be scholars, but they are not. There are people who sit on the pulpit of the Messenger of Allah, but they do not have the credibility to do so. And it is our duty to be very careful who we listen to, because it will have an effect on our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about being very careful who we listen to when it comes to our religion. There are many, many speakers out there, and it can be quite overwhelming at times if you look at it through this lens, that there are people out there who, you know, might be claiming to know the religion, but they don't. One of the things that we find in the traditions themselves is that when you are looking for an individual, be very careful if they instill the respect and the fear, the reverential fear of the Almighty Allah in your heart, then that is a good speaker. If they clear up the lines between truth and falsehood, then that is a reliable speaker. And of course, if they are dealing with the problems at hand, if they are creating awareness, if they are really helping to guide the people, you know, these are certain qualities and characteristics that will help you to be able to find a speaker that can help you. But without any embarrassment or without any shame, we humbly believe, and we really believe, I guess, that one of the best scholars to be able to follow is Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. His words on the traditions and the Quran is truly amazing. And if you're looking for a religious scholar of the highest caliber who can help to differentiate between right and wrong, truth and falsehood, and really help us to live an Islamic lifestyle, then Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei is definitely one of the best scholars to be able to do so.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
in the limelight.
About 750,000 American people are forced to work or lose food stamp benefits because of the new bipartisan compromise over SNAP. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truth Out, in the course of the recent resolution to the long brewing debt ceiling crisis in the U.S., it was congressional bickering that drew the most attention. Although it was largely drowned out by senatorial diatribes, the final June 2nd debt ceiling measure included a substantive change, a modification to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, widely known as food stamps. The new SNAP policy, reached through party negotiation and compromise, mandates an increase in the maximum age at which recipients will be subject to work requirements. Previously capped at age 49, the age range of the work mandate will now incorporate a new sliver of the population, for whom unemployment will preclude benefits. Able-bodied adults without dependent children, ages 50 to 54. More positively, the bill also codified new exceptions to the same requirements, rendering three groups, young people from 18 to 24, who had grown out of foster care, all veterans and all unhoused people newly exempt, leaving those particularly vulnerable populations out of the program's work stipulations will certainly offer welcome protections. However, there are caveats to this kind of parceling out of benefits. Among them, the burden of determining eligibility, which will fall on clients and state administrators alike. But it is the work requirement age giveaway to Republicans that is projected to have the most punishing social consequences, with ramifications for hundreds of thousands of low-income people. In the course of deficit reduction negotiations, Republicans naturally targeted their age-old nemesis, the hungry poor. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy advocated for upping the work requirement age, purportedly in the interest of sparing more adults to join the workforce, while, of course, slashing benefit rolls. His initial proposal applied to adults ages 50 to 56, 2 years older than the final arrangement. The Republicans won their work requirements and so were at least pleased by the chance to impose struggles on a whole new swath of the marginalized. But ultimately, the bill's features derive from a compromise reached between the Biden administration and Republicans. Democrats, for their part, were able to bargain for the exemption of those three vulnerable groups, which will ensure nutritional assistance, at least for some. Yet the upshot of this bargaining is that the final compromise is satisfying to no one. Professedly committed to cutting spending, that is, unless it's directed toward the military or corporate tax cuts, Republican leaders were displeased to learn from later estimates that the new SNAP arrangement will cost an additional $2.1 billion as a result of the exemptions. Meanwhile, some liberals may be chagrined to learn that thanks to the right, a considerable segment of the population is likely to lose their benefits entirely. Before assessing the impacts of these changes, both the increased age limits and the new exemption categories, there is some context to consider. During the officially declared pandemic, now on paper concluded, a portion of the federal funds sent to states for COVID relief were earmarked to expand SNAP benefits. These emergency allotments, or EAs, according to an analysis from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, kept 4.2 million people above the poverty line in the last quarter of 2021, reducing poverty by 10% and child poverty by 14% in states with EAs at the time. The estimated reduction in poverty states due to EAs was highest for Black and Latino people. But once the federal emergency declaration expired, those enhanced allotments quickly dropped to pre-pandemic levels. Some states had already begun to wind them down. NPR reported these reductions have diminished benefits for as many as 16 million people, losing an average of $82 a month. Some will lose as much as $250 per month. Emergency allotments had already been rescinded before the new SNAP modifications were passed on June 2nd. Now, on top of the fact that benefits have already been weakened, this increase in the work requirement age from 49 to 54 is expected to impact, per the CBPP, as many as 750,000 older adults. 750,000 people now must work or lose food benefits entirely. In public statements, Speaker McCarthy framed the requirements as a boon to the citizenry, a first rung on the ladder to success. He added, "Work requirements lifted people up more into have jobs than ever before. It helped supply the chain." And the controversy here is, do we believe in the work ethic or not? Professor Julia Henley is the Deputy Dean for Research and Faculty Development at the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. In a conversation with Truthout, she drew on current research to convey a number of complicating factors around these policies, adding some nuances that have gone unaddressed by cable TV commentators. Henley said, "We have good evidence that work requirements historically don't align with the motivations for clients using public benefits. There is this assumption that people don't want to work, that using the benefit is reducing their work effort, and we have to motivate them to work and not become dependent on welfare. I'd say that's mostly a political argument. That's not a lot of research to really back that up." The actual results of forcing aging low-income people to return to work a minimum of 20 hours a week in either employment or job training belie the Republican claims of work requirement efficacy. The right's professed interest is in driving people off benefits and towards self-sufficiency, but research indicates that their policies will produce much of the former, with highly dubious impact on the latter. While work requirements do probably induce some people to look harder for work and to meet the requirements, I think there is pretty good evidence that the establishment of work requirements also results in people falling off the program, Henley noted.
IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. The families of the martyrs still feel an emptiness due to the departure of their loved ones. Whatever we have is due to such sacrifices. Whatever we have is because of such nobility. We are all indebted to them. Every time I meet the families of the martyrs, I pray that God will keep them for the Iranian nation. I would like to share a few points about this great action taken by the Navy. The first point is that what you have accomplished is a clear example of the ayah, prepare against them whatever you can of power and war horses, the Holy Quran, Surah 8, Ayah 60. The Quran clearly instructs us with no interpretation needed to prepare against them. It is said to prepare whatever you can in the face of your enemies. You see, this is the Quran. It is not a mere religious possibility or an ambiguous narration. It is a clear ayah from the Quran. Prepare against them whatever you can.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You need to increase your preparedness as much as possible. What you did was an example of these noble words. You increased your preparedness. You demonstrated your abilities. Even though the action you took was the result of the efforts that had previously been made, but this in itself became a precedent and a foundation for greater things that will be accomplished from here on. This is how it is. You did this preparedness. So the first point was that 86 for the Tilan's achievement was an example of the ayah, prepare against them whatever you can. What you did improved the confidence of our forces. It elevated the level of our military capabilities. It strengthened the belief of we can in the people's minds, and such a mindset is the basis of our progress. The enemy also backs away when it sees this. That is how it naturally is. In the continuation of the aforementioned ayah, it is stated, eyeing thereby the enemy of Allah. You need to increase your preparedness so the enemy feels that you are prepared. One of the things that encourages the enemy to attack is when it feels that the other side is passive, weak, and hesitant. Such a situation encourages the enemy to take action. But when it sees that you are awake, prepared, capable, and knowledgeable, it will naturally think otherwise.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost, guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
South Korea kicked off yet another round of large-scale military exercises with the U.S. by conducting Air Force drills early this week. South Korea says the joint drills are based on an all-out war scenario and will involve field training and command post exercises and address cyber threats and terrorism. The drills follow the recently concluded trilateral summit with Japan at Camp David, where President Biden warned the DPRK and other countries.
We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation. And critically, we've all committed to swiftly consult with each other in response to threats to any one of our countries from whatever source it occurs.
The joint U.S.-South Korea drills under President Yoon actually lead to a decline in national security, say some NGO leaders.
If the large-scale military exercises of South Korea and the U.S. continue, North Korea will respond with provocations. And then strategic assets such as fighter bombers of the U.S. forces will be engaged, and the vicious cycle carries on. At this rate, these military exercises will expand further and become regular. So, of course, the tension on the Korean Peninsula will increase.
The DPRK has indicated it will launch a satellite in the coming days as it seeks to bolster its surveillance activities.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has reversed course in much of the country's foreign policy. Engagement with the DPRK has been replaced with confrontation. And while U.S. President Biden praises President Yoon for his political courage, many South Koreans oppose his policies.
Trilateral cooperation with Japan is particularly touchy in South Korea for historical reasons, and opposition to the Fukushima nuclear contaminated water release further damaged sentiment toward Japan. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Change in the world can come if nations function on the principle of mutual cooperation and respect. But the imperative is to break free from the status quo, and BRICS leaders have a number of proposals they want implemented to realize this. Among the most urgent being accelerating de-dollarization, establishing a common currency, and countering Western-imposed sanctions.
For me,
through the new development bank, we can offer our own alternatives for the adequate financing that will attend to the needs of the global south. Through the help of my sister Dilma Rousseff, the bank will manage to face the challenges. The creation of a common vetted unit for our trade transactions and investments for BRICS countries will increase payment options and reduce our vulnerabilities.
With an increasing number of countries wanting to join BRICS, the group presents prospects of prosperity, cooperation and development. As the sessions were underway here, India successfully landed its Chandrayaan 3 mission on the moon. And this is the type of expertise and know-how that can hopefully be shared through a mechanism such as BRICS.
Through initiatives such as the BRICS satellite constellation, the vaccine R&D center, mutual recognition of pharma products, we are bringing about positive changes in the lives of ordinary citizens in BRICS countries. Through initiatives such as the Youth Summit, BRICS Games, the Think Tanks Council, we are strengthening people-to-people ties in all countries.
The West's reliance on sanctions has inadvertently strengthened those it wanted to isolate. Russia highlighted how sanctions have hampered the international economic system. And even with traditional allies of the United States, such as Saudi Arabia, knocking at BRICS's door, change looks very much possible. BRICS now stands on the threshold of becoming a far more influential body, one which will shape a new world order and present a true challenge to the West's stranglehold. The final day of deliberations, which will look at expansion, will decide its future. Hassan Siriyap, Santon.
Money laundering. Simply put, it means one conceals the origin of the money obtained from illicit activities. The term money laundering is said to have its origins in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s. Most gangsters, such as Al Capone, used laundries as a cover for the illegal money they made because the amount of cash flowing into laundry operations was challenging to track. This way, large sums of money could be processed without being noticed. Governments have been dealing with this issue for decades, working hard to put an end to it. In 2008, Iran established the Economy Ministry's Financial Intelligence Unit, or FIU, headed by the country's economy minister for this purpose. On Tuesday, the FIU held Iran's first national anti-money laundering and financing terrorism conference in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 senior managers from different institutions took part in this seminar to discuss strengthening and developing necessary infrastructure to prevent and deal with corruption, especially money laundering. Speaking on the sidelines of the conference, Iran's economy minister Ehsan Khanduzi said the Islamic Republic has higher standards in blocking the path of money laundering and financing terrorism compared to many countries in the world.
According to the financial and judicial reports, important measures have been taken in Iran in the field of fighting against money laundering and financing terrorism, which is unprecedented. We expect the FATF working group to adopt a technical approach in its evaluation instead of a political approach.
Khanduzi also pointed to Iran's membership at the Financial Action Task Force, saying Tehran's position in the FATF is active, not passive. Organizers of the conference say it has provided a perfect platform for the senior managers of Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Keeping Iran's financial system healthy is one of the priorities of the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi. In this regard, Tehran has been taking serious steps to combat money laundering and deal with disruptors of the economy. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
On almost every commercial street in the Belgian capital, there is evidence of failed businesses. The country's statistics office recorded 1,092 bankruptcies in June alone. Bridi Said has been in business for 30 years. He says things have never been so tough.
Difficult to find the rent. Rent is expensive and a lot of things together, and the war, sure, and the war.
Across the 27 countries that make up the EU, bankruptcies increased by 8% in April, May and June compared to the previous 3 months. That's according to Eurostat, the bloc statistical office, which says the increases are at their highest since it began collating such data in 2015. We've raised the issue with the European Commission.
What are the EU authorities doing to try and support these firms under pressure?
The answer was, we'll get back to you with a response. Many analysts say high inflation and rising interest rates are happening in the EU because sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. The bloc is sending deadly weapons worth billions of euro to Ukraine amid growing calls for peace talks. This is a subject we also asked the bloc's executive arm about.
Is there a realisation within the EU that, you know, this current war as it stands, it's unwinnable?
Hopefully they will win. Hopefully they will win soon. We are supporting Ukraine. We will support Ukraine for as long as it gets. Of course we want to see peace, but the peace needs to be on Ukrainian terms.
The EU released a further 1.5 billion euro to the Ukrainian government on Tuesday. Back home, the social crisis is deepening and millions are struggling to pay their mortgages due to interest.